Hey everyone, want to see Dumbledore die? Today's book is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, a father, and this is the saddest Harry Potter book for me because of how much Hermione ends up settling.
And I'm David Vance. I want to know, if Snape knew all those tricks that make potions better, why didn't he share them with his hundreds of students? Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince is a 6,000-page Russian novel dealing with cancel culture, specifically the KGB canceling your brains onto a wall.
And this is The Book Pile.
Quick reminder to please rate and review The Book Pile. If you do, Kellen will mail you half his blood.
Which I know is 4.5 pints based on a book that I read. Based on our least downloaded podcast. So, Dave, this is our 50th episode. All right. Well, I care. And in honor of it, we wanted to announce something fun. So we are going to record our first live podcast on October 29th. It'll be at Improv Broadway in Provo, Utah. It's a great comedy club run by the great Zach Atherton. It's going to be an amazing show. You'll get to see us live. You get to see Dave quote obscure nonfiction books off the top of his head. You'll get to see me make fun of Dave, and all of this in 3D. Plus, I'll be doing some stand-up to open the show, and there'll be a Q&A with you, the audience, to close it out. It's going to be super fun. Tickets are available at improvbroadway.com. $15 online, $20 at the door. So if you want, you can wait and we'll make more money. No, I imagine this will sell out. So this will be the first of an ongoing series of live shows. If you want us to come to your town, email us at thebookpilepodcast@gmail.com to help us gauge interest in your area.
Also, we're doing a book signing, so bring us any books we haven't written, which is most of them, and we'll sign it. Could be a car manual, could be a journal. If you bring something by Orson Scott Card, I'll sign it multiple times as revenge for when I was a kid and he got all snooty when I asked him to sign Chamber of Secrets. And also, just to get ahead of this joke, we won't sign anything that would be super offensive, so spare yourself the comp. Finally, our next two books are Talk Like Ted and The Two Towers, which I learned recently, I think Tolkien must have just really liked that title because he considered up to 5 different towers. Like, if you read the book and had no backstory, would you have any idea what the towers are?
Which ones he's talking about? No. All right, without any further ado, here are our 5 favorite lessons from Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. All right, lesson 1, a good title can be a mystery. So it's not essential to me because there are plenty of books with lame titles that are still great books, you know.
The Old Man and the Sea.
And not all the Harry Potter books, not all of them have titles that are mysteries, but most of them make you wonder about something like the Chamber of Secrets. Who is the prisoner of Azkaban? The Goblet of Fire. That one's answered about 100 pages in, what that is.
The Deathly Hallows, it doesn't answer what it's about forever.
Mm. And so this has nothing to do with the point I'm making, but I thought it would be fun to rename the Harry Potter books using actual movie names. So Harry Potter Book 1, Romancing the Stone. Book 2, Anaconda. Book 3, The Godfather.
These are great.
Book 4, The Maze Runner. Book 5, Fast 5. Book 6, Total Recall. And Book 7, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story.
Just because everyone dies? Yeah. All right, lesson 2. Find ways to avoid doing the things you hate. So I want to tip my hat to J.K. Rowling. There's something I think she doesn't actually like writing because she's always getting out of it, and it's Quidditch. Because she'll be like, oh no, Harry got detention, no Quidditch. Or, uh-oh, lifelong ban, no Quidditch. Or, there's this other tournament going on that affects four students. No Quidditch. There's a monster that only attacks indoors, so we're banning outdoor sports. Two times, Harry falls unconscious in the middle of the match. It's like, you know when someone postpones their wedding for the slightest thing, and you're like, oh, this doesn't bode well.
I like to think that she realized halfway through book two, like, how illogical and boring Quidditch is. So that's why she shies away from it, sort of like how Star Wars Episode 1 was 50% Jar Jar Binks, and then Episode 2 was 1%. George Lucas is just like, I'm just going to try and set him to the side here. I'll put different clothes on him. What I'm saying is, Quidditch is the Jar Jar Binks of sports.
Another thing, it seems like Sorting Hat Poems was something she did in book one, and then was like, no way am I doing this seven times. Because she's like, oh no, Harry fainted. Or he's in trouble. But I do say this as a genuine point. I think there's value in getting out of the kind of work that you hate. Like, for me with workouts, it's way better for me to find the kind of workouts I enjoy than to just grit my teeth and do stuff I hate out of discipline. Like, I'm way more likely to stick with the first kind. Mm-hmm. I had a work mentor, Carter Dredge, who told me, you'll never change the world doing work you're not passionate about.
Huh. That helps out a lot, because I often wondered why the world wasn't changing when I was fixing water softeners for 12 years.
But I'm putting in my 10,000 hours.
All right. Lesson three. When a hero needs information, just have them conveniently overhear that information. So I don't pretend to know how to write a masterpiece series of novels, though I used to when I was dating. But one thing that's funny to me is how many times in every Harry Potter book, the story moves forward because Harry is in the right place at the right time to overhear something vital. Uh-huh. To me, Harry's real gift isn't Quidditch, it's eavesdropping. And I think that it would have been fun to have a moment between him and Dumbledore, where Dumbledore is like, you've got your mother's eyes and your father's craving to listen in on private conversation. And so I know I'm splitting hairs here. I love these books. I love this book. I didn't really notice this until my last read of this book. So I can't say that it ruined anything for me. She does everything else so well of having things and motivations happen so organically, but it does seem like a bit of a shortcut. So here are a few of the ones that I noticed on my last read. The first time Harry, Ron, Hermione, they see Draco bullying Mr. Borgin at Borgin and Burke's. And this is actually Harry's second time eavesdropping here. The first time being between Lucius and Borgin when Harry accidentally ended up inside Borgin and Burke's because of a flu mistake. You could say it was a fluke. It's just waiting for you to boo me there. Another time, he overhears Draco talking to Crabbe and Goyle in their compartment on the train. At the end, Harry is essentially eavesdropping invisibly when Snape kills Dumbledore, which is really euthanasia, right? And on his way to Dumbledore's office, at one point, Harry encounters Trelawney, who is just in the room of requirement, hiding her alcoholism, where she overheard someone cheering. And then she also tells Harry that on the night of her interview with Dumbledore, the night she shared the prophecy all those years ago, Snape had been eavesdropping on the other side of the door on their conversation. So my takeaway is, if you want to avoid more drama in your life, talk quieter.
One of my favorite things when someone says something private within hearing distance of you is when they immediately then switch to speaking in much quieter voices. Because then you're like, oh, I might not have even caught what you said until you just signaled to me that you're talking about something private. Do you think any like East German spies who spent all that time like surveilling dissidents, do you think they read Harry Potter and they're like, oh, you never get that good a haul just following someone once? you have to wait and wait.
Yeah. So accidentally eavesdropping can be like reading YouTube comments about yourself. Because one time I was performing on this cruise ship, we put on this variety show, and I had to follow these two guys who were street performers by nature. So they're bouncing all over the place. They were basically like acrobats slash dancers slash comedians. So they would be doing these stunts, like backflips off of each other to really fun, like R&B music. And then there'd be a record scratch and one of them would deliver a one-liner and then back into it. And they just crushed. And then I come out there and I'm just telling people like my observations about the movie theater. These are people, they're not necessarily like stand-up comedy fans. Like, they just came in because the buffet is closed for 1 hour between lunch and dinner. So this is like, I get up there, I do my set, and then when all of us are filing out of the room, I'm just walking out with the crowd. I hear this guy behind me say, "Man, the comedian had some good jokes, but he was so slow."
And so you waited 10 years to make a rebuttal.
That's all I would overhear with my invisibility cloak, so no thanks.
Just mean things. I do love stories about performers having to follow someone they absolutely do not want to follow. I know I told this on one of our very earliest episodes, but I love that right after the Beatles played the Ed Sullivan Show to a crowd of screaming, adoring girls, they were followed by a pair of comedians. Okay, lesson four. Remember the importance of place. So I want to do an experiment, and I think it's going to have as much scientific validity as Why We Sleep. So Kellen and listeners, I'm going to rattle off 20 places in Harry Potter world and keep a tally. How many of these do you have a vivid picture of in your mind? All right, Kellen, you ready?
Ready.
Hogwarts, Privet Drive, Gringotts, Room of Requirement, Gryffindor Common Room, Great Hall, Azkaban, Quidditch Pitch, the Hogwarts Lake, the Shrieking Shack, Ollivanders, 12 Grimald Place, Forbidden Forest, Hagrid's Cabin, Dumbledore's Office, Quidditch World Cup, Ministry of Magic, Chamber of Secrets, the Burrow, Diagon Alley. Okay, what's your number?
All of them.
Right. So I have vivid images of all of them as well.
If I would have said 11, then you would have said wrong. All of them.
So I have vivid images of all of them too. And I sometimes go home and get lost in my hometown, the metropolis of Idaho Falls. So I think JK knows the value of place, like cool places, memorable places. So look how scenes in this book are more memorable because of where they happen. So Dumbledore doesn't just die, he gets blasted off a castle tower. Draco doesn't just get attacked, he gets attacked in a bathroom and he bleeds all over the bathroom tiles. Dumbledore drinks a potion in the middle of a creepy lake full of dead bodies. Which, don't you want to see that as a jet ski commercial?
Or a Smartwater ad. Smartwater. If you don't want to finish it, have one of your students force feed it to you.
Thirsty? Come drown in smart water. Anyway, I think the value of place goes way beyond writing. So there's this book called Who's Your City that says, you know, we spend so much time deciding what and who, what's my job, who will I marry, and not much time deciding where should I live, even though where has a huge impact on what and who. Mm. Which I love the idea that where changes what and who, partly because it sounds like Abbott and Costello still trying to do who's on first, except now they're old alcoholics. Another example of the power of place, you can have the exact same skill set and make way more money just depending on what country you live in, like many multiples. So my takeaway is just remember how valuable place is.
And try to be born in a rich country. Also, I think the Universal Studios is missing out on a huge opportunity by not having a Half-Blood Prince themed indoor pool.
I think the opportunity they're missing is, okay, picture this Harry Potter experience. They lead you down into this cavernous bank, and open a bank chamber, and you get to leave your gold inside.
Are you a Harry Potter fan and libertarian? Well, bring your gold on down to...
And if you try to come back for it, you're killed by a dragon.
And also for the indoor pool slash cavern experience, to get inside, they're like, all right, you have to wear a mask, make sure you're vaccinated, and then bleed all over this wall. When people look down in the pool, they're like, oh, there's dead bodies down there. And the lifeguard is like, spits out his Gatorade and he's like, yes, it's all part of the experience. I guess the true theme park experience with that indoor pool would be that when anyone even like starts to get close to the pool, the lifeguard's like, don't touch the water. Do you think when someone orders water at a restaurant in Flint, Michigan, that the server is like, all right, would you like sparkling or gray? All right. Lesson 5. You can't make a well-written story shorter. So this is a short one. I just think that J.K. Rowling is such a master at cutting out the fluff in her stories that making her books into tiny stories that the movies are is impossible. Mm. I feel like she's so great at self-editing that everything has a purpose. And so when you try and cut any of it out, her story is like a chain. You can't cut any of the links.
It does almost feel like you spend all this time working on a 1,000-piece puzzle and a producer comes in and is like, all right, we're going to make a movie out of the 10 most important pieces.
That's a great analogy. I mean, the audiobook for The Half-Blood Prince is 19 hours.
Wow.
And the movie is 2. So the thing that bothers me about the movie, though, is that I understand when a movie needs to cut stuff, and so it aims to just go for the tone of a book or the tone of a story and keep the most important things, but they don't even try that. They cut out so much, but then they add things that don't add anything to the story. The movie basically starts with Harry in a Subway coffee shop where he hits on a waitress. Like, and then 15 minutes later, he's like, actually, I'm in love with Ginny for no reason. So it's not only is everything cut down, but it also makes less sense. Like, it takes away from the story. There's no Grop. There's no apparition lessons. There's no Scrimgeour. How do you pronounce his name?
I always say Scrimgeour.
Scrimgeour?
I think Scrimgeour is more correct, and Scrimgeour is way cooler.
Scrimgeour. The biggest one to me is that in the movie, only 2 memories are shown, and in the book, there are 7. Stuff like the heartbreaking story of Voldemort's parents.
Yeah.
His mom, who is, homely because she came up from a family tree of wizards where it's implied they were incestuous just to keep the pure blood line going. And I imagine that that sort of family tree looks more like a palm tree. So she uses a love potion to make one of the Riddles fall in love with her. They have she gets pregnant, and then she stops giving her bewitched husband the potion, hoping that he would have just fallen in love with her anyway, but he leaves. And also, we won't get into how she's committing pretty heavy crime.
But let's just gloss over that love potion section. Let's gloss over it the way Dumbledore glosses over it. He's like, she was in love. I'm sure she thought he would love her back by this time. It's like, whoa, 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 Dumbledore.
Love. But to me, all of that gives more layered context behind love potions, which in the book, Ron also encounters with Romilda Vane. But in the movie, we only see Ron's part of it. And so it leans way more like into the rom-com portion of the story. And that's like the biggest thing for me between the movie and the book is that the book is like the darkest of the books so far. But in the movie, half of it is about relationships. And by the way, I don't care. I don't care who 16-year-olds love.
Is that what you say as a parent?
That's absolutely what I say.
Okay, random facts. It is sad that one of the characters who was cast perfectly right in Harry Potter died and was replaced by someone cast perfectly wrong.
Yeah, it's too bad that first Dumbledore didn't come back to life.
His body's floating in a lake somewhere. Ready to grab you if you touch the water. Oh, that would have been a really sweet shout out to him. Make him one of the Inferi.
Yes. It's too bad Richard Harris didn't have a Horcrux.
So given how much Snape hated Harry, it's kind of funny to know how unhappy Snape would be to learn Harry named a child after him. So Harry's name is Harry James. His sons are named James Sirius and Albus Severus. And what's funny is that in each name, one of those names got the other one killed.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, that's like my son, John Wilkes Abraham Lincoln.
All right. Or my son, Grandpa Cigarettes. So the most Ron Weasley fact about Ron Weasley is that between Sirius cutting open his four-poster bed and Slughorn giving him poison wine, there were two assassination attempts on his life, and neither one was meant for him. They were both meant for someone more important.
Something else I hate about Ron is that he's not even good enough to make the Quidditch team without cheating. And Hermione helps him cheat. When Hermione's trying to rationalize, like, the first time she's ever cheated with something, she says that McLaggen wouldn't have been good for the team anyway because of his temper. And then at the next practice, Ron has a huge temper.
Man, this is not going to go away, is it?
Ron just, he just gives her no reason for her to like him. What's their story when their kids are like, hey, how did you guys meet? And they're like, well, we hated each other for 6 years and that's it.
Well, I was also good friends with the most famous young wizard in the world, who was a rich athlete who was always incredibly selfless, literally walked to his own death to save wizard kind, and never walked out on me during our adventures. And for some reason, I married his best friend.
So I think the subtitle of this book could have been, it's darker, yes, but at least Harry isn't whining anymore.
So, you know those people who are so annoying about wanting you to know they're bilingual? Harry's like, oh, was he speaking Parseltongue? Oh, I didn't even notice. I'm just so fluent. Or Morven sings a lullaby in Parseltongue, and Harry probably says to his friends, oh, it's much more beautiful in the original Parseltongue. We don't really have a word for it.
That's another thing. They cut out the whole House of Gaunt story, which I think would have been amazing and dark and interesting. And instead, we almost got Trolls Dancing Ballet. That's a real scene that was produced and cut from the final edit of the film. Of movie 6.
Wow.
I can't imagine what's happening in these writing sessions where they're like, I mean, yeah, we could visit Voldemort's mother and grandfather and the abusive, you know, wizard household that they grew up in. Or, you know, it would be hilarious.
I like the audacity of the screenwriter who is like, I'm going to take a story told by maybe the most successful author in history, rivaling sales of the Bible. And I'm going to use her trademarks to market a story where I smuggle in my dancing troll idea.
It's like when Ridley Scott was like, I'm an atheist. I think I'll make a movie about Moses.
And then it fails and Hollywood is like, people don't want Christian movies. So I have a system for solving all the wizarding world's problems. So you do the sorting just like normal, but if they're sorted into Slytherin, they get kicked out of the school. So no Voldemort, no Death Eaters, no Chamber of Secrets, no Draco letting Death Eaters in, no like abusive potions master, no betrayed Lily and James. I call it wizard precog. Can you think of any wizarding problem that would persist if just the Slytherins couldn't do magic?
Oh, man. Yeah, without the Slytherins, the only drama left is like, why is a Gryffindor dating a Hufflepuff? Uh-huh.
Why is anyone, really?
With the Slytherins unable to do magic, the only dangerous thing still at Hogwarts would be Hagrid. It's crazy that Hagrid is allowed to work there.
Dumbledore really does hire a lot of very incompetent teachers.
It's like, I care about 1,000 students' safety. But what's even more important is this one half-giant's feelings.
Genuinely, the good teachers they ever have, it's like McGonagall and Flitwick, and then the werewolf who ran loose and almost killed a student, and the Death Eater who tried to kill a student. Dumbledore turned down Minister of Magic because he was power hungry and then became a terrible headmaster. Seriously, though, look at Dumbledore's track record as headmaster. A student dies like every year. He has hired multiple people who are legit evil. 3 or 4. He personally recruited Voldemort to come to the school.
It seems like when Dumbledore was interviewing people, all he needed to do was add a sneakoscope to his desk and everything would have been fine. And then there's like, it provides you with a scapegoat. You're like, look, if it were up to me, I'd love for you to teach Defense Against the Dark Arts, but this little toy here won't stop ringing.
It always bugged me when people were like, well, Dumbledore trusts Snape, and that's good enough for me. And it's like, yeah, and he trusted Quirrell and Moody and Lockhart. All right, to recap, our favorite lessons from Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. 1, a good title can be a mystery. 2, find ways to avoid doing the things you hate. 3, when the hero needs information, just have them conveniently overhear it. 4, remember the importance of place. 5, you can't shorten a well-written story.
And 6, remember to go to improvbroadway.com for tickets to see us live in Provo, Utah, October 29th, 2 days before Nearly Headless Nick's death day.